Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Sarah Kovner about her book, Prisoners of the Empire, Inside Japanese POW Camps. Prisoners of the Empire is a nuanced look at the experiences, the narratives, and the popular and historical memories of those experiences and narratives of Allied POWs in Japanese custody, especially English-speaking POWs and their narratives in the English language world. While never denying the horrors of war and the POW experience in particular, Kovner finds less sort of systemic and intentional cruelty by Japanese camp commanders and guards and staff, etc., than she does poor planning and poor preparation, and often outright neglect when it came to the fate of internees. Simultaneously, the book is sensitive to how POWs' experiences differed enormously due to their status in the eyes of the Japanese, as well as the time and place of their captivity. In particular, Kovner contrasts the experience of white, mostly Anglophone POWs with Asian POWs, who were more likely to be subjected to systematically poor treatment. In addition, Prisoners of the Empire also explores the ways that Japan was, quote, present even when it was absent in the 20th century history of international agreements on POW treatments and war crimes. So Kovner has produced a significant, thought-provoking contribution to several different subfields of history. In addition to its obvious relevance to those interested in the history of modern Japan and World War II, the focus is on World War II, and historical memory, because of its considerations of such issues as the Geneva Conventions, also war crimes trials, the books will also be of interest to readers interested in international law and international relations. So, Dr. Kovner, thank you and welcome to the podcast. So, as always, I want to start off with our traditional open question, which is, how did you become interested in this particular project?
Thank you for having me, and please call me Sarah. I got interested in this project when I was researching my first book, Occupying Power, Sex Workers and Servicemen in Postwar Japan. And it was towards the end of that project, and I found myself in Geneva in the papers of the archive for the International Committee of the Red Cross. And I was looking there. I knew that there were Swiss on the ground, and I thought that perhaps they had written something about sex workers or at least servicemen buying sex. Much to my disappointment, I found nothing about this. But the archivist, knowing I was interested in Japan, suggested I look at their materials on Japan. And there I found all of these reports on prisoner of war camps. And, you know, so I'm a historian of Japan. I went to graduate school to teach about Japan. And this is not something that was part of the story that I learned. I mean, I'm American. And so I had learned about it. I'd heard about it sometime and read about it. It's part of my, lived experience or the experience of relatives, older people that I know. And but it seemed to me that this was an important part of Japanese history that for my students, for Americans, it's, you know, something I often get asked about. And here was the archival evidence that I had never looked for. And therefore, that's how I got interested in it.
So I'd like to start off talking about your introduction and conclusion together. I think it's useful to do that in order to get to some of the big issues that you're talking about. So in both the introduction and the conclusion, you really lay out the way that your book is confronting some critical distortions in the popular memory of the experience of allied POWs, especially in Japanese custody, especially distortions in the sort of English language scholarship and public or historical memory. And so where most people see a kind of intentional cruelty, you seem to see a lot of just poor planning and neglect. And so I have two questions about this. So I'd love you to first tell us more about this basic argument you're making and what you want readers to come away with at the kind of macro level. What's the big takeaway, right? And then second, if I'm reading you right, you're arguing, especially in the conclusion, that stories of savagery and brutality on the part of the Japanese are kind of, for lack of a better word, convenient. In other words, that there, factors including the propaganda, et cetera, sort of and racial attitudes make this a useful story and one that kind of resonates and has stuck. I feel like I may be oversimplifying this a bit, but I'd love if you could expand on that for us.
So first I should say thank you for having me, and please call me Sarah. So what I'm trying to do in this book is to talk about how everyone knows how much allied POWs suffered at the hands of the Japanese, but we don't know why. And here what I mean by everyone is Americans and Australians and British. And what my book does is it reveals why they were neglected and abused. And there are a couple of reasons. One is a lack of planning. The Japanese Imperial Army never expected to take so many prisoners. Also, poor training. They didn't prepare troops or commanders for this task. And the people that were sent to the camps to be camp commanders were third-rate officers, people who were recalled to those jobs. Also disorganization. There was not a clear chain of command, and this stands in contrast to places like Germany. And logistics were poor. And then, of course, there were things that existed in some camps and not others, and the experience of captives could be really up to the camp commander. And the big takeaways from my book, as far as I'm concerned, are that we think of war crimes as being intentional, committed by evil planning. But some of the worst experiences come about through poor planning. And in this case, the leadership just didn't care. There's nothing inherent to Japanese character or culture that led to the inhumane treatment of POWs. Japanese government and military never made it policy to abuse POWs. And the horrors of captivity were because of bureaucratic indifference to a large extent. And to me, what's so shocking is how senior officials gave much less thought to their management than today's accounts assume. And it's Japanese inattention to the challenge of managing POWs and lack of interest in caring for them that led to much of the cruel and inhumane situations. And in terms of your questions, the kind of latter part of what you were saying, and the question of oversimplification, I think that, as you well know, historians will always tell you that history is more complex than you think, right? But this is an important part of the story. No doubt many people suffer brutal experiences, and I've read and come across many of these accounts, but no one cared to find out why, or few cared to find out why. So there's a presumption that there's something particular about the Japanese. And to me, the more interesting question is there a particular policy of savagery or brutality that the Japanese applied? Or was there something particular about the Japanese? And this is not something that I found.
Yeah, I've been thinking and writing a little bit about wartime Japan. I'm trying to write a book about food and nutrition. And so that question of war planning comes up a lot. And I think a lot of the suffering of the Japanese as well comes from the exact same sort of indifference to planning, just lack of forethought and all these things. And so this really sort of resonated with some of the things I've been thinking about. And I found it one of the really powerful things, about your book. So I wanted to ask one other question about your sort of, you know, big picture introduction, conclusion, because one of the points you make in the introduction, and you return to this a couple of times throughout the book, is on the other hand, right, we've talked about that there's, you know, a lot of variety and sort of diversity in the way that people are POWs are treated, and that there are, and you point out that there are significant and sometimes fatal differences in the way that Western and non-Western POWs tended to be treated by Japanese soldiers and the camp commanders. In your conclusion, for example, you write that Allied POWs' treatment varied widely, as you've just said, you know, depending on where and when they're captured, physical conditions, climate, proximity to Tokyo, and most importantly, perhaps the camp commander. The treatment of, for example, Chinese POWs is much more uniform and decidedly not in a good way, right? And I just want to quote you here because you say, here there's significant evidence that Japanese commanders planned to deal with them harshly from the outset in China and throughout Asia, including both civilians and servicemen. So I guess, I mean, there's a certain intuitive answer to this, but why were the Chinese so poorly treated? And to what extent did this apply to other Asians? And why or why not?
So this is a really important question, because I think that the case of the Chinese shows what could happen when senior Japanese leadership had a deliberate policy and plan. And for just one example, there's significant evidence in Singapore, something I write about in my book, that ethnic Chinese were treated far worse. There, the 25th Army headquarters, and many of these soldiers and officers had military experience in China, are using harsh retaliatory measures similar to the ones they used in China. And the Japanese military in Singapore believed the ethnic Chinese would oppose their rule and killed somewhere, and this is a large fan, but between 5 and 50,000 ethnic Chinese. My book is mainly about a particular category of captive, prisoners of war, who were covered by the Geneva Conventions, which established standards of international law for humanitarian treatment in war. And Japan, of course, is a signatory to what we think of as the first two conventions at this time, right? And they agreed to follow them mutatis mutandis, meaning depending on circumstances. And the Japanese should have come under this category once there was a state of war in the Second Sino-Japanese War, right? But, and yet there were fewer than 100 so categorized. As you mentioned, also the treatment of all captives was wildly differential, so it's difficult to generalize. And as to this question of other Asians, I think this is even more complex. For example, returning to Singapore, when we look at the 60,000 Indians taken prisoner after the Battle of Singapore, right? And in this case, the Japanese supported the formation of the INA and tried to recruit them. And then the experience is yet different in places like in Dutch Indochina.
Yeah. So this is, yeah, I think this is, you know, a really, as you said, a really important point that you're trying to make throughout the book. And I want to, you know, go back and contrast this with the sort of prehistory that you lay out in chapter one, right? Because as I sort of mentioned in the introduction to the podcast, of course, you know, this is really a book about World War II. Mid-century. But you do a really interesting prehistory that touches on World War I and some of the, you know, the Russo-Japanese War, et cetera, in chapter one. So I want to talk about that. So you're proceeding chronologically from the turn of the 20th century, you know, even through the end of the occupation, as the Allies then try to reckon with the that war at Geneva again. And you start, though, with the story of how Japan carefully repositioned itself as this sort of model civilized nation in the way it treated at least some of its POWs, and how this fit into its sort of initial modern foray into great game politics. So the Red Cross, the Japanese Red Cross, for example, engagement with international conventions on war, which you've just mentioned, the POW camps for Russians during the Russo-Japanese War, Germans in World War I. These are all sort of showcases for the level of Japanese civilization, right? And though, as you point out in the former case, there's this ominous contradiction in how the Japanese treated the Chinese and Koreans who worked for the Russians, right? So you also point to conflicts between this sort of outward-facing embrace of the West in the Japanese military, and then the social structure within the barracks. And I thought this was a really critical part of your larger argument about the treatment of POWs and that it sort of spills over into World War II. So I'd love for you to sort of flesh that out for us.
Okay, so as you know, and as you've commented already, so during the early part of the 20th century, Japan is seeking to follow international law to demonstrate the extent to which they're a civilized and cultured country. And this is the build-up to how well and why the Japanese were so determined to treat Russian POWs well, prisoners well, during the Russo-Japanese War. They held some 80,000, and their treatment was world famous. And of course, they are also holding Germans during World War I. And then after World War I, or after what many people think of as World War I, we have fighting in Siberia and the Siberian intervention in the late teens. And this may have encouraged an indifference to human life. And among officers, it led to the view that being taken prisoner was dishonorable. And then in 1939 at Nomonhan, right? This is something we talk less about today, many of us at least, but it's a major conflict in which 100,000 troops clash. When men fell in battle there, comrades often abandoned them on the field. And then the Japanese army bureaucracy preferred to list those missing as killed in action rather than to accept that some were POWs. But it's estimated that a 1,000 to 4,000 Japanese were captured, maybe most likely 3,000. So this is the fighting part of it. And in terms of this really famous or infamous no surrender doctrine, the military code announced on January 8th, 1941, instructed soldiers to, quote, not accept the shame of being a POW. And this makes explicit what had been implicit in the account that I just gave you. It's better to die than be captured as a POW. And this is done in part in earlier decades through the publicization or institution of the Way of the Samurai. And Oleg Benesch has done really good work on this, I think. But in considering this doctrine itself, they wouldn't have had to threaten punishment if soldiers really believed it, right? So at one point I'd like to make about this, it seems obvious in retrospect that at least some Japanese servicemen would still surrender. This no surrender policy, to my mind at least, is an attempt to establish a norm and to influence behavior. And it had really negative unintended consequences, such as leading officers and guards to feel contempt for the POWs they captured and detained. And then I guess the final piece for me is in 1933, Japan announcing its withdrawal from the League of Nations. And so then its politicians' hopes for equality with the West were dashed. And this is the death knell for internationalism.
Yeah, and just sort of on a personal note here, one of the interesting things about doing some research here in Nagoya, where I live, is that Nagoya was one of the places where there was a German POW camp. And our city archive has some top secret materials from the original POW camp. And there's apparently a little like a local historical society that deals just with that camp. Our archivist, though, what was interesting is he showed me this packet of materials, which specifically say, you know, top secret, make sure it never falls into the hands of foreigners. And he sort of gleefully showed me this, which I, you know, is one of my favorite things about the archive is they're really good that way. Anyway, so I want to move on to chapters 2 and 3. That's not necessarily germane to your book. But so chapters 2 and 3, you've already referenced Singapore. That's chapter 2, A World Gone Topsy-Turvy. And then chapter 3, The Philippines, Commonwealth of Hell. So I want to treat these two together. And I think they'd sort of make a nice unit, the sort of comparisons and contrasts. At the beginning of chapter 2, you argue that there's no such thing as a typical captivity experience in the Pacific War. The lack of planning for either POWs or civilian internees, the protracted nature of the conflict, and the changing fortunes of Japanese forces created a vortex that sent captives in highly unpredictable and dramatically different directions. Nevertheless, I thought it'd be useful to compare for our listeners the specific experiences that you document in these two chapters, because there's some telling overlaps here. And in particular, you know, the experience in the Philippines is encapsulated for many with the Bataan Death March, to a lesser extent, POW hellship transport ships. But you complicate this picture both in your chapter on the Philippines and later in the book when the roles are reversed. So I wonder if you could tell us sort of about this sort of the Philippines and Singapore and what they can tell us about the larger picture of life for POWs under Japanese, let's call it, supervision.
Okay, so, I mean, this is a big question, but I think that I'm writing this. This book is written for largely an American audience, although a British and an Australian audience as well. And for each of these audiences, they have different kinds of national memories of the conflict. And in Britain and Australia, the history of prisoners of war is something that I think is more talked about, more important, more a part of public memory than it is in the United States. And Singapore is a big part of this history in Britain in particular. And this is because it was such a tremendous defeat for the British in Singapore. And that's important in thinking about what happened. And yeah, when you really dig into the story of what happens on the ground in Singapore, this is not the accounts that I came across, at least, were not the same as the kinds of accounts that we see in the Philippines, right? So Singapore, the city state, life in Changi, which is the big POW camp there, an internment camp, because this is where many people live their lives. It's not a experience of horror really that people face in the in the Philippines. And part of that is because the Philippines is an active war front in a different way than Singapore was. And I can go more into detail. I'm not really sure, but I guess that one further thing I'll say on this is they're both different kinds of colonial experiences, where Singapore goes from being a part of the British Empire to being under Japanese rulership. And you sort of hinted at that in your question. And the Philippines, this is somewhere that, has this long history of being under American rule and then goes to the Japanese. And there are lots of specific things I could say about each of these, but I wonder, but perhaps I'll leave it for there.
Okay, yeah, and the specifics are well laid out in the book, and so I would encourage people to get into them there. I guess that'll take us to chapter 4, A War of Words, right? And so this is a sort of interesting departure from the actual camps themselves. Here you're focusing on the diplomatic dance around the Geneva Conventions and how it's handled. And I really had no idea about this through the Swiss. I learned a lot about sort of the way that international relations worked. So the Japanese and the Allies are both trying to sort of claim the moral high ground and also react to military and logistical sort of expediencies, it seems. So tell us about how sort of things are working out on the ground and the effects this has for prisoners, right? So what the diplomats are doing, what that means for the prisoners, and why it's being carried out in this way.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I didn't know about at all before I started this book, and it was something that really took me a long time to figure out how it worked, because as you know, I'm trained as a historian of Japan, and I do international history, but I didn't have a lot of knowledge about what a protecting power was, or what the role of the ICRC was and is. And in order to understand the diplomacy around all of this, I had to figure this all out. And I mean, that's part of the joy of writing a book, right? Is that you get to learn about things that you might not have known about before that are really important. And what this chapter does is it's talking about the diplomacy about it. And I've already referred to the Geneva Conventions. And in some ways, this is kind of one of the main stories that this book tells. They set up requirements and responsibilities that both sides need to follow, or the different sides in the particular conflict. What this means on the ground in Japan or in the United States or in other kinds of places is that the inspectors of the International Committee of the Red Cross are on the ground inspecting the camps. Now, they had to get permission from the belligerent power, and whether that's Japan or the United States or Australia or whoever, to inspect these camps. And in fact, they were not allowed into every camp, and only to some of them in the case of the Japanese Empire. But so that's one part of it. Another is the kinds of requirements and responsibilities that each of the powers that sign them need to do in order to sign the conventions. And to speak a little bit about the Japanese, they set up, they're required to set up an organization, an agency really, to create ID cards, lists of prisoners of war, and to transmit this information to the ICRC in Geneva. And they create another agency in order to manage logistics. They end up, in the case of the Second World War, having the same person being in charge of both agencies. But and this is not a particularly successful job that Japan is doing here. And I talk about that at length in my book, the failures here. But, you know, the way that it's organized on a... the way that it's organized is that the head of both of these agencies isn't in the chain of command, has no command authority, and few personnel working for him. And he's only serving in an advisory role. We see this in a different way in places like Germany, for example. And so in the end, I mean, the Prisoner of War Information Bureau fails in its most basic function. It isn't even able to keep track of the numbers and locations of prisoners of war. But still, I'd argue that it's important. The Geneva Conventions are important for ensuring the treatment of Allied POWs. You know, there's no way of knowing. It's counterfactual. But I think that this is true for a number of reasons. One is, on an official level, there's a conception of how prisoners of war ought to be treated, right? And there's some sort of bureaucratic mechanism for managing all of this. And even if it's not as successful as it should have been, and that's a counterfactual piece, right? We don't know what it would be like if it didn't exist. And on the U.S. side, it's really quite important for the Japanese Americans and Japanese kept in prisoner of war camps in the United States, where the ICRC, and that's not really a big part of my book, but that is, the ICRC is visiting these camps. And the way that the conventions work is they rely on reciprocity, right? So the idea is that you treat the prisoners of the belligerent of your belligerent power well, and that they will hopefully treat you well. So that is one thing that's going on in this chapter.
Yeah, and this is a sort of really, you know, it's kind of an interlude, right, between the tales of the camps themselves. And chapter five takes us back to one of those camps. It takes us specifically to Korea. And so this is Korea Life and Death in a Model Camp. And I thought that, you know, this is an interesting idea that you have these sort of model POW camps. And that's really the point of the chapter, right? So you write that and I'm quoting you here, the relatively benign conditions of POW camps in Korea seem anomalous compared with common accounts of the POW experience. Therefore, they indicate what happened when senior officials took an interest in the fate of Allied POWs in the first months of the war, and how the experience of captivity could have been different if they showed the same interest elsewhere. So especially compared to, you know, we've talked about Singapore and the Philippines, so especially compared to those relatively hellish conditions that are often talked about, what were conditions like in Korea? And then also, you know, specifically you argue that this is ironically not merely or even mainly to conform to international laws of war, which was, you know, the subject of the previous chapter, but meant to provide a model for Japan's colonial subjects. So I wonder if you could bring that part of this sort of difference between the Korean camp and the experience in Singapore and the Philippines to the fore in your explanation.
Right. So in general, we're more familiar with the stories of atrocities from the Bataan Death March or Burma Thai Railway, but conditions in Korea were quite different than these in general, right? I'm speaking in general terms. And the Japanese government was eager to show off how well they treated captives to the ICRC, who, as I've explained already, then transmit this information to national governments. But as I show in this chapter, Japanese government communication showed that the camps were explicitly set up to show Korean men and women on the ground how Japan could hold captive European officers. And they made the Japanese on purpose took a group of officers from Singapore and shipped them to Korea to show off how they could do this, I think. And I mean, and I think this is ironic. It in terms of conditions, and this is a point at which maybe I can bring this story what's going on in the Philippines together with what in Japan and Korea. One way that I tried to research this book, one way I did research this book is to, it's hard to compare the camps. And I thought that one way that I could do that would be to look at the accounts of people who were in a number of the camps. So looking at the same people who were in the Philippines, Japan, and Korea, or Singapore and Korea. And just to give one example, Lieutenant Colonel Jack Schwartz, who's a medical officer from Fort Worth, was captured in the Philippines at Bataan, was on a ship sunk by American naval aircraft. And he ends up in Jinsan, excuse me, in 1945. And he's really impressed by the conditions. This is surprising to me when I was reading about it. It's not something one typically finds or thinks of in thinking about a prisoner of war camp. And so that, you know, you quote me as saying benign, I mean, about Jinsan and Keijo and the captivity experience in large part in Korea. But, you know, that still means these are Spartan camps. They're people who are extremely hungry, if not starving. They suffered harsh climates and, you know, but they still compared favorably with others. They lived in better conditions and ate better. In Keijo, in Seoul, officers farmed potatoes and vegetables. They raised hogs and rabbits. And so then the question is why? Why is this going on in some places in the empire and not others? There are a number of reasons. First, you know, so I think that this indicates what happens when senior officials took an interest in the fate of POWs, allied POWs, and how the experience of captivity could have been different if officers took, or administrators took a similar interest elsewhere. The second thing is that Korea is not on the war front. This is quite different from the Philippines or in other places that in war theaters. Third, in Korea is the nature of the work in Jinsan and Keijo, at least. There are few large-scale civil engineering projects. Captives are working at an army warehouse, forwarding supplies to the Joseon Army, making army uniforms. Sometimes they're hired out for small civil engineering jobs. So one pleasant job is building, and that's a quotation from a diary, was building a race course for a wealthy Japanese civilian who provided us with good food and was gentle and manly towards us. And this is really not, at least what I was expecting to find when reading about prisoners of war. You know, but life isn't easy for captives in Korea or anywhere else. There's never enough food or medicine. Captives are, I think, and this is something that comes across again and again when I was reading the diaries, they're focused on their shrinking bodies. And, you know, so I mentioned some of the differences, but there are also some commonalities, right? Part of what made the POW experience so traumatic for Australians and Americans and British, even when conditions were more tolerable, is that they were being held captive by men they considered their inferiors. And another commonality is there's an element of randomness, I think, in the captivity experience based on the commander and the guards, and to some extent, group dynamics. So I'll leave it there.
Yeah, so one of the things that I found interesting about the book is that you've generally structured the camp experience narratives in these kind of concentric circles working, you know, out to in, right? So you start with Singapore and the Philippines, then we go to Korea, and then chapter 6 takes us to captivity on the home front. So you're talking about a Japanese POW camp in Fukuoka, Kyushu, the southern island of Japan. So you examine in this chapter, and similarly to some of what you've been talking about with Korea, but why accounts of the POW experience are so sharply divergent in Fukuoka, and what factors explain how they varied between camps, how they changed over the course of the conflict. So tell us about that. You know, what were some of those factors, and how were they similar or different, I guess, from Korea as well? I thought it was particularly interesting the way you, again, paid very close attention to the identity and status of the captives and how that seems to have affected their experiences and their narratives.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that I've already talked a little bit about why camps differ from each other, but just looking at camps in Japan, I mean, I think the experience of being a captive in Kyushu, just to take not the camp that I looked at, but another place in Kyushu, the experience of working in a mining camp, right? This is the most kind of the most unsafe kind of mining that we find, versus working bottling soda pop, right? Those are different jobs that people could have had in different camps within Japan. And so the treatment, the experience of being a prisoner of war is going to vary considerably just if you hold that variable the same. But what this chapter does, as you mentioned, is talk about how in one camp, the experience could vary tremendously. You know, in this one camp, this place that I'm calling one camp, it was at three different locations at different times in the war, but it's still treated as one administrative unit, right? The way that I approached this research problem, right, is I tried to track down everybody who was held in this particular camp, which is a tricky research proposition because the way that these archives are held is they're held nationally. So the experience of Australian prisoners of war. And so you have to go within that to figure out who is where. And anyway, so that's what I tried to do with this. And so as I mentioned with the case of Korea, a camp, somebody could be held in Korea and Japan and the Philippines. This is very, very common. Getting back to the idea of the question of identity and status, I'd add to that place and time, right? So that, you know, just sort of personnel changes from February until 1945, a doctor prevented the distribution of food supplies to POWs, right? So that it would be different if you were there in January of 1945 or earlier. But, and as you know, I think quite well, Japan as a whole experienced dramatic change over the course of the conflict, right? So this leads to widespread deprivation that fundamentally alters the context of captivity. This is another way in which time is important, even if a prisoner is held in the same camp. And those outside the camps became quite critical of the perceived treatment of those within. Right. So by 1945, the Home Minister is warning the War Minister that citizens were complaining that POWs were treated better. You know, this happens in Korea, too, by the way. The people outside the gates are convinced that the people within the gates are treated much better. And they were. But we also see this in the United States. We see people in who are living outside internee camps for Japanese saying, why are these people being treated so well? Which isn't really that's what the archival records show. That's not how we would consider them today, right? But these are things that people said, right? And just, you know, and in terms of identity and status, the experience of experience differ based on nationality and other kinds of identity markers. I think one thing that that happened to Allied prisoners held in Japanese hands often, which they didn't expect, was that officers and servicemen were treated the same, right? This is something that no one expected because they weren't supposed to be. Yeah.
That was just a really interesting, I was one of those people who wasn't expecting that. So one of the things that we've sort of implicitly addressed thus far is that in some ways, you know, your book is, and this is, you know, I don't mean this in the derogatory sense, it's often used, but it's a revisionist history, right? I mean, you're trying to make a very specific intervention here. Not so much, I think, in the history itself, but in thinking about the sort of, history of memory. And so this is, you know, one of the really powerful ways that I think you do this comes up again in this chapter, chapter six, more starkly than in other chapters, although it's referenced throughout. And you write, and this is a quote, as much as POWs hated the beatings and other punishments that the guards inflicted on them, by 1945, those were not the greatest threat of death or injury. Instead, it was bombing by U.S. Army Air Corps B-29s. So how great was the threat of friendly fire to Allied POWs? And sort of what does this mean to your bigger narrative about Japanese POW camps?
Okay, so the threat, just to answer your question, the threat was tremendous. More than half of the fatalities resulted from friendly fire, from Allied attacks on Japanese transport ships or Allied firebombings in Japan. The Allies bombed boats, despite knowing that Americans were abroad. We have good archival evidence in the U.S. sources and the British sources and in other places as well. I think that it is, the memory of this is really a tricky thing, to say the least. And if we look at the Australian experience, more Australians died in captivity than died fighting, right? So this is a really important thing for a part of people's memory. And all I try to do in the book is to stick as close to the archival record as I can.
Yeah, that seems like probably a pretty good idea given how fraught this is. Yeah. So I'm gonna do a little bit of violence to your book here and treat chapters 7, 8, and 9 again as kind of a unit here. I hope that's okay, because this is about the kind of post-war settlement part of the POW question, which when I picked up the book was not really something that I expected to be a part of it. And yet it turns out to be, again, another really interesting intervention that you're doing in thinking about what this all meant, not just in terms of national memory, but in terms of legal, post-war legal international law kind of settlements. So chapters 7 and 8, that's chapter 7, endings and beginnings, chapter 8, undue process. These are about post-war treatment of Japanese POWs and accused war criminals, respectively. And in both cases, you argue that the treatment was haphazard and highly variable, which is becoming a refrain for the way that a lot of things were treated in the war, I think. So what were the similarities and differences in the ways that soldiers and officials were treated? And what does that tell us then about the Allies? And I want to connect this to something you say in chapter 9, right? Because you look there at a number of different war crimes trials carried out in different places, the Philippines, Singapore, et cetera. And you're quite skeptical, and I think a little bit critical, of the scattershot nature of the punishments meted out.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. So when I was writing this book, the way that I started thinking about it was to think about the difficulty of gathering evidence to bring people to trial. Because a lot of the evidence that I came across in various archives was evidence collected by the people who were, by the American JAGs who were collecting materials to prosecute the Allied war criminals, right? And so that is how it is organized in the US archives as well as other national archives. And so what you see people doing is gathering accounts from prisoners. For example, they're placing advertisements. The US government is placing advertisements in a local newspaper here. This is why I knew about it in Long Island, in New York, called Newsday, to, if you've been a prisoner of war, then please come in and we can get your account. I mean, they tried to interview them as soon as they came out of the camps, but they also had to take more evidence from them once they had returned to the United States. And in seeking to gather evidence to try members of the Imperial Japanese Army, they had to gather accounts against guards whose names prisoners didn't often know, right? They referred to them by nickname, and they were trying to, to triangulate the guards and the prisoners, and this was quite a challenging task for people who didn't speak Japanese, either the investigators or the prisoners of war in most cases, right? And I think it's really a difficult process to run a war crimes trial at the end of a war. This is not something unique to this particular war. These war crimes trials, but it's shouldn't be understated. And it's clear that abuses and suffering and tragedy happen. But the question of who is responsible is a difficult one. The prosecutors couldn't fix responsibility on one person or explain the policies that cause suffering. And it was easier to imagine, I think, that everyone was a war criminal. And so that meant that the trials could be arbitrary. And as the historians Sandra Wilson and Robert Cribb have found, and others, that translators and medical personnel were at highest risk of prosecution and conviction, right? So that doesn't mean that they were more responsible, but merely that people, that the prisoners probably remembered them better, right? And were able to identify them. And the main trial of, I referred earlier to the Prisoner of War Information Bureau and Management Offices, the organizations, the agencies that were responsible for running Prisoner of War, and the trial of its. They only had one person left to try because the other two heads had committed suicide. And by the time this trial was run, they're using, his name is Tamura. He's more a symbol than anything else, a high-level bureaucrat who headed a powerless agency. But as I mentioned already, abuses happened and there needed to be a resolution. And then when you follow the story further, right, the aftermath of when, after prisoners are held, when I mean prisoners here, I mean the the guards who were responsible, right? When they're released, it's driven by the politics of a new Cold War when Japan becomes an American ally.
Yeah, I found throughout that the way that you sort of trouble the moral certitude of the good war, right, is really, you know, a sort of powerful thing that you're doing here. And I think this is, you know, the last sort of set of questions I want to ask here goes a little bit to that and the sort of long-term ways that we've tried to deal with some of that messiness in terms of international law. So this, again, is going to treat chapters 8 and 9 together. So in chapter 8, you point out that Allied prosecutors and judges struggled with some legal issues that were quite difficult in their cases against camp officials. And this question of, you know, who's responsible, you talk about the commanders, the doctors, the guards, right? And so then in chapter 9, which is Prisoners of History, renegotiating the Geneva Conventions in the wake of war, you really talk about how that affects the renegotiations of the Geneva Conventions after 1945, right? Namely that though it's not a party to the negotiations, quote, Japan could actually be seen to have had a big impact on both international law and societal understanding of how captives should and should not be treated in wartime. Japan was present even when it was absent. And then you go on to sort of conclude that bringing Japan into the picture helps us to see, you know, the flaws, the shortcomings, as you put it, in the process itself. So if you could sort of finish up by explaining what you mean about that.
Right. So I'm talking about this moment when the Geneva Conventions are negotiated or renegotiated after the war. And, you know, as we all know, Japan is at this point under the Allied occupation, so it's not a sovereign state. So they're, for that reason and others, not permitted to actually be a part of the renegotiation of the Geneva Conventions, but they still attend to Japanese and to Americans serving to represent the Allied occupation. And we know from their records that they were not sure they should be a part of it, right? They had a lot of specific questions about Japan. If Japan, after all, was to be giving up aggressive war, then, you know, then how would Japan deal with all of these questions? But in terms of the renegotiation of the Geneva Conventions themselves, these have often been mentioned, but not consistently applied since their renegotiation in 1949. I teach a class in the fall on war and captivity, and we look at the Korean War and the Vietnam War. It's mostly U.S. history focused, but and all the time you're hearing about the Geneva Conventions, but they're not, and there are good reasons why, but they're not used, but they're often mentioned. And Japan, the experience of allies fighting or the experience of allies in captivity during the Second World War was important in the renegotiation of the conventions themselves, because some of the people, the Australian representative, for example, the Australian delegate, had been a captive, right? So his life story was really important to how we thought about how these conventions should be renegotiated. And, you know, it's sort of inseparable from it in lots of ways, whether that's prisoner treatment and this kind of thing, or the importance of civilians. And I would just finish up by saying that when Americans discuss how captives should be treated, how foreign captives should be treated in the U.S., this is an experience that's referred to, the experience of Americans held captive in the Second World War. But to me, it's mentioned, but we don't think about it, right? We don't think about it as this was an experience that was where Americans underwent a lot of suffering, and therefore we have rewritten these conventions, but yet the American government doesn't, I mean, different administrations, it depends on the administration, isn't perhaps as ready to keep this experience close to mind as I think they should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And I think that's a really great place to wrap up, because it speaks to the sort of, you know, the larger importance of the book, beyond the sort of questions that, you know, you and I have as Japanese historians and people thinking about the history of memory, but also these, you know, the way that it's still affecting the world we live in today. So I want to, in that same sort of forward thinking mode that we're now in, ask you about what it is that you're up to now that you have this book out, and what we can expect from you in the future.
Yeah. So I've been working on my next project, which is going to be about the internment experience of civilians. So the first book was about allied prisoners, right? These, and then the next book is about civilians held captive. And so this is what I got really interested in, the experience of internees that we know so well in the U.S. This isn't, of course, just a U.S. experience, part of American history. They're Japanese held captive in Australia or in Britain. And the records are all mixed in with the records that I was looking at. So I've had an archival head start, but that is my plan for my next project.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. And I hope that when that book comes out, that you'll be back here on the podcast again. No pressure. But I hope to see you then. And I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today and let you get back to whatever it is that you're doing in lovely New York.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.